And our sermon text is found in Mark chapter 15, verses 16 to 32, pages 852 and 853 in your pew Bible. Mark 15, 16 to 32. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is the governor's headquarters. And they called together the whole battalion. And they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling down in homage to him. When they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes on him, and they led him out to crucify him. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. You ever been mocked and scorned like that? Something similar. It's tough to take, isn't it? As a young man, Julius Caesar was captured by pirates near the Mediterranean island of Pharmacusa, and he was held for ransom. His biographer Plutarch calls these particular pirates, Sicilians by ethnic origin, a set of the most bloodthirsty in the world. And crucifixion was not unknown in the ancient world at this time, as we know, even in Caesar's time, and they had been known to practice it, these pirates. Caesar, however, appeared to be nonplussed by their threats and their reputation. When they demanded 20 talents for his ransom, he laughed at them and said they didn't know his true value, and he offered 50 talents instead. Caesar also entered into their games, and he joked with them as if they were his keepers, not his captors, as Plutarch says. And for their part, the pirates laughed at Caesar. They mocked him too, thinking him simple of mind and boyish. They took Caesar's threats to return and kill them as mere idle threats of a boy who was adept at boasting, but who was, in truth, incapable of carrying through with those threats. They refused to believe that he was of Roman patrician stock, as he was, and that he would one day rule the known world and whose name became synonymous with kings and emperors, right? The very name Caesar. We get Kaiser and Tsar even from his name Caesar. They had indeed underestimated their prisoner and little knew what their ridicule would cost them. When the ransom finally came, Caesar was released, and he immediately sailed to the port city of Miletus, raised a troop, hired some ships, and off he went after the pirates. He surprised them with their ships still in harbor, and he captured them. They could hardly believe their eyes. Here was this young punk kid who they mocked and mistreated, and now he had them in his power. True to his word, Caesar seized all of their treasure and had them all crucified on the spot. How typical this is of our human race to underestimate and be utterly unaware of whom it is who stands before us. Have you ever been mocked and scoffed at and like this. It's hard to take, isn't it? Sometimes we wish we had the opportunity that Caesar had, don't we? For our persecutors. But add to this the mocking and the scorning of a man who was precisely who he said he was. Indeed, Caesar was, wasn't he? And you have a prescription for vindication, don't you? A prescription for vindication. It's a measure of Caesar's sheer exercise of will as a great man of history that he found vindication so thoroughly and utterly. I just put before you, how many times can this be multiplied in the case of our Lord? Huh? In his suffering and persecution before us in this text, Jesus was a king, yet he was scornfully mocked as a pretender. Jesus was the Messiah of the Father, yet he was derided as if he were delusional. Jesus was the perfect God-man sent from the Father, yet he was rejected as a blasphemer and is still rejected as such today, isn't he? As great as history judges him, Julius Caesar was a mere man, acting upon the world stage of mere men out of that fallen, limited motive of ambition. Jesus of Nazareth was much more than a mere man. In fact, the one upon whom all of our race waited. His death and suffering, as unjust and undeserved as it may have been, accounted for much more than a vindication by a mere mortal, doesn't it? Our text unfolds that for us today. Let's look to it here for a few moments as we look at crucifixion. That's our title today. The inside flap of your bulletin, you'll have five brief points that I want to outline here for you that our text brings out for us as we look at Christ and his crucifixion here this day as we come to our first day in the Passion Week, crucifixion. As every king requires, verses 16 through 20, as every king requires, Jesus of Nazareth is supplied with an army. But with a twist, right? As every king requires, Jesus of Nazareth is supplied with an army. He is a king, isn't he? What a ways we have journeyed since we first began our pilgrimage through the Passion narrative of Mark, haven't we? It began simply enough with a meal at which Mary Magdalene anointed Jesus with precious, expensive nard. Since then, the quiet unfolding has morphed, hasn't it? This quiet, prayerful setting of the Passover supper in the upper room, the hours of prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane have seen this gradual increase in pace and plot, haven't we? We've seen that. I told you that was coming. The guilt-ridden, furtive arrest of Jesus whisked away to this kangaroo court conviction of as a blasphemer by the Sanhedrin and rushed then to the politically expedient death sentence of a man on a political bubble with his emperor, Pontius Pilate. And finally, Pilate's sentence is pronounced. Let him be crucified. Let him be crucified. What does that mean exactly? If it were you or me who heard such a fate pronounced over us, how would we have reacted? Would we have said, well, at least he didn't take away my driver's license? Not knowing anything about crucifixion, perhaps, maybe we would say, hey, Pilate, does that mean I have to report to a probation officer every week? Perhaps our attitude would change when we found out that it was, in fact, a death sentence and that we had but hours to live. And after the shock and the grief had subsided, perhaps even heroically resigned to meeting our end, we might say, well, if I gotta go, I don't want hanging. How barbaric that is. Or a firing squad, that's noisy. And I hate needles, so lethal injection is out of the question. At least it's crucifixion. By the way, what is crucifixion? What is crucifixion? Crucifixion was of ancient origin with centuries of practice to perfect its technique. The Persians began by simply impaling their enemies in the open sun on crude stakes. But when they saw how long it took for men to die and how painfully they suffered, they said, aha, we've got something here. And although many others contributed to its advancement as a means of execution, including the Greeks and the Carthaginians, it took the brutal, sadistic, efficient Roman Empire to perfect it, to perfect crucifixion as an instrument of political punishment. They developed very consciously these features of crucifixion. Number one, it was exquisitely painful. The criminal was nailed or tied to the crossbeam by his hands and to the stake by his feet. If he let himself hang there by his weight, he would constrict his ribcage and suffocate. If he attempted to stand and relieve that suffocation, he would tear the tissues on his hands and feet. All the while, flies consumed his flesh, the beatings he endured hurt his flesh, hunger and thirst went unrelieved, and the merciless eastern sun baked him and drove him crazy. Crucifixion was also interminable. The Romans had perfected it such that a victim would remain alive precisely as long as they wanted him to suffer. It could go on for hours or days. In the end, if the Roman legionnaires saw rain coming or they got hungry or simply bored, they would break the legs of a crucified victim and he would sag in place and suffocate and pass out too from the shock. And finally, crucifixion was inhuman and degrading, as you can hear just from its description. Once nailed to a cross, you were something else than human. Less than an animal, an object of shame, victims were stripped naked, crucified naked, and so mutilated and humiliated that people could hardly stand to even look at you for a moment. As Isaiah put it, they turned our eyes away from him. While the Roman Empire seized upon crucifixion as an apt death for political prisoners in particular, those who sought to overthrow the emperor, undermine or rebel against her in any way, shape, or form. A man would look upon a crucified king or rebel and say to himself, whoa, maybe I'll just keep my mouth shut, not say anything against taxes, tyranny, or Tiberius. For such things, the descendants of Hannibal in Carthage were crucified. The slave rebellion under Spartacus was repressed with crucifixion. Countless minor insurrections in this part of the empire were met with the same fate. And now, with a rebel aspiring to be a king, as we saw last week, just another day in Pilate's entourage, Jesus of Nazareth, what more fitting punishment than death by crucifixion? So, ostensibly, this was the pretense under which Jesus was turned over to the Roman legionaries for the execution of Pilate's sentence. Were they the distant, objective, detached administrators of an executive sentence, these Roman legionaries? Or can we believe the account before us of what they did to Jesus, huh? What they did to him? The text tells us that they were anything but scrupulous, sensitive, reluctant executioners, were they? Historians like Josephus and Suetonius tell us that these legionaries were not the citizen soldiers of the old Roman Republic. Honorable citizens who were serving temporarily until a particular danger to the Republic passed. But rather, these were paid conscripts culled from the dregs of Eastern Mediterranean society. They were paid by and served the emperor exclusively. They were on permanent duty, and two conditions characterized their lives, as in the lives of many soldiers throughout history. Boredom and brutality. Boredom and brutality. These two realities led to inevitable behavior. See what they did. They employed their sadistic imagination by dressing Jesus in a ragged royal robe and a prickly crown. These legionnaires finally had their hands on a real king. Sure, you're a real king. As an obscure nobody, what would you do to a king if you could get your grubby little hands on one, huh? Behold. Behold in your text. They mocked his claim. How many like him had they seen? He was just another in a long line of rebels who had failed. How pathetic. They made him suffer. These legionnaires knew death, didn't they? Or as Sergeant Barnes would say in the movie Platoon, what do you know about death? What do you all know about death? Huh? These legionnaires knew something about death. They were trained to refine their skills in administering it, too. They were experts at death. They knew when a man was terrified, when he was an hour from death, a minute from death, and most certainly knew when he was a lifeless corpse. They could manipulate the circumstances of suffering to bring him to any one of these states or more. Now they get this fellow of whom the whole region had been abuzz. A king, a messiah, a lord to rival Caesar. Let's see how much of a king he was. So it is that King Jesus acquires an army, but with a twist. And all through this section, Jesus is taunted by what he enjoyed, didn't he, as the second person of the divine Trinity in fellowship with the Father and the Spirit, that is a heavenly host of angels, to fight and overwhelm all that the devil could throw at him? Remember what he told Peter when Peter took up the sword? He said, put your sword back into its scabbard. All who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? Yet here, he has a different kind of army, doesn't he? Roman legionnaires who want only to see him suffer and die. But crucial is the difference in purpose, too. Why Jesus puts up with this. But how then shall the scriptures be fulfilled that it must be so, Jesus tells Peter. That's the clincher. Here, Jesus willingly, consciously foregoes an army that could crush in a moment, that he might be subject to an army that could crucify. And this he did for your sake, brother and sister in Christ, dear listener. This he did for your sake, for my sake, so that his suffering might stand in the place of yours. This is what we deserve. As many were astonished at you, Isaiah says, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind. By oppression and affliction he was taken away. Isaiah captures this suffering so eloquently, doesn't he? Out of the anguish of his soul he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Christ's suffering made you accounted as righteous when you did not deserve it. He gave up an army to defend himself, that you might have one to defend you on the day of judgment. Christ and his righteous army of saints, that's what we will be. Seize this while you may, brothers and sisters, because the time is soon coming when you will stand before your judge. Who will you have in the defense docket at that time? Well, Christ goes on to make his other identifications as a king. That brings us to verses 21 and 22. Crucifixion. More than physical pain. More than physical suffering. As every king requires, Jesus of Nazareth is supplied with a retinue of servants, but with a twist. What great king has not had an endless host of servants and ministers to meet his every need and fulfill every office required? Is there a weight to be lifted? Let a servant do it. Is there a law to be written? Let a lawyer write it. Is there a biscuit to be baked? Let a baker bake it. In the ancient world, there were ministers whose task was nothing else than to ponder what offices were needed by a king to supplement his needs. Imagine that. Growth of government, where we have men who do nothing but ponder on how we can grow government to a fantastic size. This included the Roman Empire. And it included this retinue that was the ever-present symbol of the litter bearer, the one who bore the carriage of an emperor long before the advent of motorized horsepower or even harnessed horsepower. And to this, our gospel writers address themselves here. King Jesus has a litter bearer for his throne slash carriage, doesn't he? For the average run-of-the-mill Joe in the ancient world, to be a litter bearer for a king would be a rare once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Good food, a roof over your head every night, a royal set of clothes to wear when you hump the king's carriage. What more could you ask for just a few hours of work a day? What do you think the competition was for such a place, huh? What do you think the competition for litter bearer of the crucified one, Jesus of Nazareth, was, huh? Zero, zilch, nada, I submit to you. Who wanted to bear the crossbeam of one on his way to death? This is why the emphasis for all of the gospel writers is the same. They compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, to carry his cross. This is a genuine what, who, me moment for Simon, too. We have here a devout Jew of the dispersion who's coming in from the country, an expression, returning to his family's place of origin at the time of the annual festival, Passover. But one of the unfortunate features of Roman occupation was the right of impress. The right of impress. That is, that the emperor had the right to commandeer anyone or anything from amongst the conquered territories that he felt was needed for a particular mission. And here some of his soldiers needed a strong back to get this condemned prisoner from point A to point B, and this guy was a likely prospect. So the sergeant exercises his prerogative, and Simon of Cyrene is compelled to bear the crossbeam to the place of execution, Golgotha. Now, Jesus, King of the Jews, he has his royal retinue, a troop of Roman legionaries leading the way, ensuring the prisoner does not escape or get killed before arriving at his destination. And bearing the load of his 50-plus pound crossbeam, made of dense, durable olive wood, probably used repeatedly, is this servant, Simon of Cyrene. Church tradition has it that Simon and his sons were all converted either here or soon after the resurrection. The Apostle Paul refers to this son, Rufus, asking the church at Rome to greet him on his behalf. Rufus, one chosen by the Lord, Paul says. The receivers of this gospel, too, Mark seems to know their familiarity with him and mention him. But on they go. What a pathetic retinue, huh? What an unlikely, inglorious, random set of characters. Yet God has so ordained that here, at this crucial juncture in redemptive history, Jesus has this particular set of men to surround him. The promise was just a short while ago, they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. Remember in his Olivet Discourse, where he will indeed have a host in heavenly glory. That's not now, though, is it? You can see why the temptation for Jesus was to achieve these means by another way, another route. Because now he is approaching Golgotha under a cloud, in great weakness and humiliation, not in power and glory. And this he does once again on your behalf. Enduring what you deserve. Remember, all through this, this is what we deserve, brother and sister in Christ. But he endured on your behalf. The righteous for the unrighteous, bearing your sin, my sin. And he acquires then yet another royal bearing. Here, that brings us to verses 23 to 25, crucifixion. As every king requires, Jesus of Nazareth is attended with food and clothing, too, but with a twist. But with a twist. We have copies of ship manifests that detail the rich cargo that daily flowed into Rome, destined for the cup and plate of emperor and senator. Kegs of fine wines and beers from Sicily and North Africa, lamb and beef from Greece and Gaul, rare spices, pheasant from the east, fruits and vegetables from Lebanon and Egypt, wheat and barley from Spain, and 1,001 other delicacies from every region of the known world. And I'm getting hungry. If it were even remotely heard of, it'd be sent for by the emperor. If it could be had at any price, it would be purchased by him. He had limitless resources at his disposal. The same could be said of the clothing and fabric that adorned and pampered the bodies of royalty. The traditional senatorial robe remained the same, white linen interwoven with purple. But everything else was fair game. Styles changed. They came in and out of vogue just as fickly as they do today. The Roman poet Juvenal gives us several satires of Roman royalty, characterizing, for example, the women of Rome who slavishly followed these styles of the day as, these are his words, pampered mules driven through the mud of the streets of Rome when it rained. He paints this old picture. The elements became the great equalizer when it rained in Rome, straightened the curls in the women's hair, and made those poofy shapes of clothing cling to the otherwise hidden, corpulent bodies of the aging wives of senators. Juvenal, he was merciless in his satire. Well, Jesus, too, is showered with exotic beverage. A merciful narcotic was this wine mixed with bitter-tasting myrrh. Had he taken it, it would have helped to dull the pain of crucifixion. That was the intent of this narcotic. And he, too, is adorned with a royal robe, a purple cloak, twisted crown of thorns. And adding insult to injury, the legionnaires lay claim to any property that survives to this point, too. The parallel Gospels note that they shred his clothing into equal portions, with the exception of this one quality piece of clothing that he had, a seamless cloak that just seemed a shame to tear. So they gambled for it. Cumulatively. Now, as we see this narrative unfolding, it becomes increasingly pathetic and disgraceful, doesn't it? Here is the model and prototype of a king, the great and eternal suzerain of the covenant. No pharaoh, no emperor, no Caesar, no French or British king can rival the Christ in his glory and his majesty. The Old Testament is replete with his power and glory, isn't it? Daniel chapter 7 says, "Behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed." So what a mockery this is. Here is this one, the author of life, put to death at the place of a skull. A death the creative imagination of whose creatures rival that of their true father, the devil, here. Is he worthy of this? Does he deserve it? If not Jesus, then who is deserving of this kind of death? Who is deserving of this kind of death, huh? When you stop and think about it, it's those around him administering this travesty. But not us, right? Not us. Why, if we had been there, right? Even as the scribes and the Pharisees would say, if we had been there in the days of our fathers, we would not have done the same things. Oh, I don't think so. Jesus said, you will do worse. And I submit to you, if we had been there, we would have done precisely the same thing. We are deserving of this as well. And our place is further indicated too. Verses 26 to 30. Crucifixion. As you look at this scene unfold, be thankful that it was him and not you. Be thankful that it was him and not me. Verses 26 to 30. As every king requires, Jesus of Nazareth presides over the judgment of criminals, but with a twist. He's numbered among them. In the ancient world, there was no separation of powers, no distinction between the administration of executive power, legislative power, and judicial power. A king was expected to be a wise judge as his prime directive. And Isaiah lays this out very clearly for us in chapter 11 of his prophecy. He describes the righteous judge of the earth in chapter 11, verses 1 through 5. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit. The spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might. These are all requisites for a judge. The spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide disputes by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. See, this is part of the judgment of a just judge, as the men who surround him on the other crosses. Righteousness shall be the belt of his waist, and faithfulness the belt of his loins. Isaiah 11, verses 1 through 5. Prime directive of a judge. As a prototype of the emperor and as his delegate, Pontius Pilate had just judged three men this day. On he goes to relax and enjoy the life of a gentleman, play 18 holes maybe. But little did Pilate know that in this abortion of justice, he was judging the righteous judge of all creation himself. Speaking truer than he knew, Pilate had quipped Jesus, "What is truth?" Had Pilate been of the truth, as Jesus indicated, he would have listened to the voice of the Christ and he would have executed true justice. Instead, the righteous judge of all the earth now hangs on a cross with fellow criminals. As Isaiah said, he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. As we indicated last week, the judgment of Christ is an indictment of all men, not just this generation, this particular generation in the narrative. Excuse me. It is not the Jew who is a Christ killer, as we hear from twisted minds so often. What a distortion of this very narrative and its larger point. It is not the Jew who is the Christ killer alone. Gentile Rome pronounced the sentence of death. Gentiles nailed him to the cross, divided his garments. Gentiles mixed with the Jews to shout, "Crucify him." In fact, in every voice, every face, in every vignette of this narrative is to be seen every one of us. Had we been members of the Jewish Sanhedrin, we would have been acting out of the spite and envy Pilate observed, wouldn't we? Had we been in Pilate's sandals, we would have judged with the same conniving self-interest and injustice as him. If we had been one of his disciples, we would have slunk off into the dark, hoping no one would recognize us as having been with him in his glory days. And if we had been in the nameless crowd, we would have been crying out with that same bloodlust, "Crucify him, crucify him." In the judgment of Jesus, we are all judged as a race. And it's vain flattery to think that we would have done otherwise. But in submitting to our judgment, God sovereignly used it. Jesus serves the purpose of his Father here, doesn't he? He poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. And this is you, too, when you acknowledge by faith what Pilate refused to see. Those of the truth hear his voice. Do you hear his voice today? Do you confess and freely believe that he bore the sin of many, you included? Do you see this? Do you embrace this by faith? He makes then intercession for you, dear transgressor. Christ was not only numbered with the transgressors, but as we see in verses 31 and 32, then, as every king requires, Jesus of Nazareth is hailed by his subject as king, but with a twist, right? Verses 31 and 32. as every king requires, Jesus of Nazareth is hailed by his subjects as a king. How princes, potentates, and presidents love to hear the praise and the acclamation of their subjects. We see this reprised all the time, don't we? How flushed they feel when their approval ratings soar to 70% and above. And how chagrined when they drop to 40% and maybe lower. And how many men of ambition and drive seek power precisely for this reason, to hear their names on the lips of adoring crowds and know that they will go down in history. Yet how many of them are worthy of such adoration and worship? Here we see Jesus with a crude sign nailed above his head. King of the Jews. His tormentors surround him and they taunt. If he so bragged about tearing down the temple, rebuilding it in 3 days, the least you can do is come down from the cross. If you were so powerful to save others, save yourself. Oh, great king, come down from the cross and we will believe. If we could reduce irony to its core essence, this narrative would be it. Little did his tormentors know but that their taunts were true. Jesus of Nazareth is indeed King of the Jews, is he not? And because he is King of the Jews, he is the Messiah who will bring salvation and deliverance to all men, Gentiles included. And the temple of his body, which is what he was describing in metaphor by calling it a temple, the temple of his body even now being destroyed, as he predicted, will indeed be raised in 3 days, will it not? Even had he come down from the cross, however, they would not have believed, right? We find this time and time again. Despite the demonstrations in history, men refused to believe. They would have made some other excuse. More importantly, had he come down from the cross, none of them or us would have found salvation. That was precisely the temptation laid before him in the garden. Redemption, salvation by some other means. Not God's ordained means. But instead, as Peter observes, Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit. There's nothing that I can do or say here that I can reach into your heart and solve this day in Jimmy the Lovers so that you believe. Faith in Christ is a sovereign divine gift bestowed by God in his will and in his timing. Our exclamation should never be, come down from the cross and we will believe. But rather, when your eyes are opened and you indeed do see that truth of Christ and his salvation offered here in the crucifixion. But rather, we should say eternal thanks for remaining on the cross in order to make belief possible and powerful. Dear listener, today, because your king submitted to death, even death on a cross, your eternal judgment is judged. Because he was numbered with the sinners, your sin is forgiven. Because he died a dark death at his Father's hands, you will live. And this life is promised you for faith in him. He has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God, Peter says. Now, with his subsequent resurrection and ascension into heaven, with angels, authorities, powers having been subjected to him. As Caesar got his vindication, there will be a heavenly and eternal vindication. That's the topic, the subject of the entire book of Revelation, isn't it? It is no longer in question that he is a glorious king. Resurrection Sunday has justified him. Do you believe this? Part two next week. Do you believe this? We often endure shame and taunting and mockery, have you? Hurts, doesn't it? Precisely part of the suffering of Christ. The one who deserves it least has endured it to the greatest degree. Yet he did it on your behalf, for your sake. So look to this one today who has suffered in your place, suffered what you deserve at the crucifixion. Look to Jesus today, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, the author of Hebrews says, despising its shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. May you come to see the infinite value of Christ's sacrifice in the crucifixion, that you might believe and come to infinite life, eternal life in this resurrected and ever-living now Christ. Let us now come to that place where we find his death, burial, and resurrection reprised.